RCR with Paul Brennan, Reality Check Radio.
Judith Yeapsley is the confident eater. She's passionate about supporting parents of fussy eaters. She works with 100 plus families each year, resolving picky eating challenges and returning pleasure and joy to the meal table. She is an AOTA accredited picky eating advisor, an internationally certified nutritional therapist, a speaker, and an author. And she joins me now to help us with picky eaters. Judith, welcome to RCR. Thanks for coming on.
No, that's great. Thank you, Paul. I'm I'm excited to be here.
Okay. AOTA, what does it stand for? Exactly.
So it's the American Association of Occupational Therapists, who are one of the bodies that work with picky eaters. So picky eating is a bit of a curly one because occupational therapists, speech language therapists, psychologists, dietitians, pediatricians, there's a whole gamut of people, specialists who work with picky eating because it covers a lot of domains. And so there are a lot of places, unfortunately, where eating can go wrong.
Okay. I'm thinking back to when I used to sit as a kid around the dinner table. Dad would come home from work. The meal, predictable meal, would have been created by mum and put on the table. And if any of us showed any sign of being picky on anything, there was a glaring look, you know, like that Pink Floyd thing. If you don't eat your meat, you won't get your pudding or something like that. And there was no argument. We just ate. There was no room for pickiness.
Yes.
Have things changed or was I too compliant?
Well, it's an interesting one because I think there's kind of arguments for both sides of this. So I speak to a lot of parents who are my generation who were brought up with the school of you don't eat, you go hungry, and that's tough. And they have all sorts of traumatic stories of, having to sit at the table for 10 hours because they didn't eat their peas, or their stew for breakfast because they didn't eat it the night before. And I also follow quite a lot of the sort of the adult picky eating sites just because it's, you know, part of my stuff. And there are so many adults who really were forced to do things that were outside their comfort zone. And has this led to a joy of food? The answer is usually no.
Right. Okay. Though, and thinking back all those years, it was good food. You know, there was no reason to be picky.
And I think that's the other side of the argument that if we didn't eat in our day, there wasn't anything in the cupboard because, you know, you had your meat and your potatoes and your vegetables, and if you didn't eat those, you were hungry. Whereas these days, there's a whole cupboard full of whizzy bits, and if you don't like the dinner, you can go and have your crunchy, snacky things, and they're very Moorish. And so I think, you know, there's obviously there's arguments on both sides of that.
So where does pickiness in eating come from? How does it develop?
Well, this is an interesting one because eating is very complex. So when we think about eating, the top thoughts are probably, you know, life-sustaining, intuitive, you know, perhaps pleasurable. But eating is actually one of the most physiologically demanding actions our body performs. It uses every single organ and all eight of our senses. Therefore, the chance of something going wrong is pretty high because if something goes wrong in any of those areas. So people always ask me, what causes it?
Yeah.
And if you've got, for example, a tongue tie, then you may not be able to move food around in your mouth properly. If you've got low muscle tone, it might affect your digestion. If your child's got sensory sensitivities, they might be put off by the way the food looks, smells, feels, or tastes. If they have undiagnosed allergies, they might feel pain every time they eat something. And imagine if that went on for weeks or even months, how you would feel about eating.
You'd be between a rock and a hard place.
Hard place.
Yeah.
You know, and they've also done really interesting studies on children who go on to be super selective eaters. And even their sucking patterns at 2 weeks and 4 weeks are different. Uh-huh. So for some children, it's just inbuilt. Right from the start, I work with multiple families where they've got two or three children where everybody eats perfectly competently, except for that one child that only manages crackers on a blue plate. And that's not something that mum has done, you know. And I've also spoken to mums who've said at 4 months, their baby would not accept a different brand of formula. They just refuse to drink it.
Brand specific at 4 months.
At 4 months old. And you know, and you've got to say, well, they must be quite sensitive to the smell, the taste, the whatever else it might be. That's not a parent problem. That's a something that's happening for that child. Mm.
You've just reminded me, actually, my youngest daughter, who became a vegan later, but then has relaxed on that as well. She would only eat, now what was it? Chicken and chicken wings and drumsticks. So we would create a separate serving for her, which was the same. Is that another thing that happens with picky eaters? They like the same, what they do like, they like the same thing over and over?
Well, yes, because if you think about this logically, if something's not super comfortable for you, you pick the safe choice and you stick with it, you know.
Yeah.
It's like I much prefer driving my own car than driving a hire car, because that hire car is far more difficult for me to do. So why wouldn't I just drive my own car?
Well, that went on for about 6 or 7 years.
Mm. Yep.
So it's quite a long period of time, actually, you know, multiple years.
Absolutely.
So it must ruffle families, potentially, when you've got one fussy eater and everyone else is on board.
It's incredibly difficult.
What's the fallout, usually?
Oh, look, there's a whole host of things. I mean, firstly, it's enormously stressful for parents, and particularly mothers, because we're hardwired to feed our child. And we're bombarded with all these health messages saying, you know, you've got to have this many vegetables and this much fruit. What do you do if your child just goes, well, not eating any of the fruit, not eating any of the vegetables? You feel like you're failing every day. It's a really public thing. You're sending your child to daycare or school or wherever, and they've got a lunchbox. And, you know, people are looking at that lunchbox and going, well, hang on, why? You know, why has little Johnny's lunchbox got these things in it, and why doesn't he eat these things? You know, there's all these things. And then if your eldest child is your challenged eater, suddenly you've got 1, 2, 3 kids coming up behind going, well, hang on, how come Ben doesn't have to eat the...
Yeah.
You know?
I could see how that could be. A lot of smoothing would have to take place. You talked about all those senses involved in eating.
Yeah.
What is the predominant sense that is, what's the word, violated or is the most uncomfortable, do you find? Or is it a mix usually?
It is a mix, but to in general, a lot of children are really sensitive to smells. So, and obviously if something smells bad, from a evolutionary point of view, our bodies are designed to go, you know what, doesn't smell good, not eating it, and that's sensible. Mm. But it's also touch. So a lot of children find the feeling of something both in their fingers and in their mouth overwhelmingly difficult.
Right. And I guess that's hard to express. If you're quite young, it's hard to explain what you're feeling.
Well, if you're a three-year-old, it's going to be enormously difficult to explain why everybody else can eat the yogurt and you put it in your mouth and you think, oh, that's an awful thing.
It'd be like torture, wouldn't it?
They actually say that for some children with really extreme sensory sensitivities, it's actually painful to have something in your mouth that's outside your comfort. Mm.
Poor wee things, eh? Mm. Okay, so how do you unpick the pickiness? What do you do?
Well, it depends obviously on the age of your child and how difficult things are. So if you had to say what's the one main thing that you do, it's you build comfort around new foods, because the reason that we don't eat them is we are uncomfortable with them for whatever reason, and maybe we're anxious about eating it because we're not sure what's going to happen with it. Maybe we've got those sensory sensitivities and we think it's going to feel awful. There's a whole range of those of discomforts that mean that new food is just a no-go at the moment. So it's getting past those challenges.
What are usually the categories of food that that you would try to start working on the problem? What sort of assessment is done? You don't have to give away too many trade secrets, I suppose. what do you just try and try different combinations until you hit it right? Or can you zero in pretty well on kind of the
This is an interesting one. So I think you've hit on one of the key sort of social, misconceptions that it's about the food. And I would say that actually the problem initially is less about the food, and that's more about the approach, the dynamics, the language, the psychological part of eating rather than the food. You know, one of my pet hates are fussy friendly recipes that all children will eat, you know, and how can that be true? If I pick 10 children, they would all be comfortable with different foods. And so a lot of parents are searching for that magical food that their child will eat happily. You know, maybe if I make this, then my child will eat. Probably not, you know. And although parents usually have a really good handle on what's well within their child's zone, the way that you approach it can make all the difference. So the difference between, oh, would you like these nuggets that you love, or this weird layered chicken dish that you've never seen before, you know, it's a no-brainer which your child is going to choose. And, of course, that's the extreme version of this.
Yeah, but how would you get them to go not the nuggets?
Well, I wouldn't give my child a binary choice and say, do you want the nuggets or do you want the weird chicken dish? Because, you know, that's only ever going to go one way.
Yeah.
And so we want to approach food in a different way that is more likely to lead to success. And part of that is by building comfort around new foods for your child, often away from the table. A lot of the work you're doing is not sitting down at dinner and going, okay, how do I make my child eat the broccoli?
Because that's in front of everybody. That's going to be a humiliation potentially, or you need to, the kid will be guarded or...
Yes,
but anticipating an awkward situation.
Yep. Exactly, but it's also late at night. You know, by the end of the day, who really is interested in doing something challenging? And particularly if you've got a 3, 2, 3, 4-year-old, you know, by 6 o'clock they're like, "Nah, done with life."
Yeah.
And as a parent, I'm usually pretty over things by then as well.
Yeah, I know that one. so it's better to one on one, is it?
I would say no, because, again, what we often do as a society is we say, there's a problem with this child, let's fix the child. Whereas I would say we need to work on what's happening in the family. And particularly if you've got a young child, who wants to drag a 4-year-old out of their home environment and go, oh, there's obviously something wrong with you. Let's fix you. I would be saying, how can we put supports into place within the family that make it more easy for that 4-year-old to eat new foods and build some supports and some comfort around both the parents and the children?
Once they get over the pickiness, let's say, is it then just business as usual, usually after that? Like, does that pickiness remain? Does it sort of fade out over time? Or is that a constant battle for the kid, but later the person?
It's a spectrum. So you've got children who eat peanut butter on crackers for breakfast, lunch and dinner and wouldn't eat anything aside from those. And then you've got the kid that goes, you know what, I prefer chicken nuggets to broccoli. And that's a huge spectrum.
Yeah, that's what you're saying.
And obviously, depending on where you sit on that spectrum, is going to determine how easy or not it is. I mean, I've seen miracles, and
I'll
put that in inverted commas, with children who are 8 and up. when they're younger than that, you're just not going to see a magical turnaround.
Right. But you're prepping the ground.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, obviously you are making improvements and you are seeing progress and you are supporting that child. But if you're starting with peanut butter on crackers and your child's got sensory sensitivities and maybe they're neurodiverse, it's not just going to be a magical, let me wave my magic wand. It doesn't matter who you are. You're not going to be able to wander in and resolve that in, you know, the short term.
You mentioned neurodiverse, and I think we know what that means and what the sort of the spectrum that covers.
Yeah.
It seems to me that there are more neurodiverse people in the world than there were. Could be wrong. So this would be a growing problem then, would it?
Well, if you're looking at, and it depends on which research you look at, but probably 75% plus of children, of autistic children, have eating challenges.
Well, that would make sense. A fixation, right?
Yep, fixations and sensory sensitivities, which go hand in hand. Yep. So, you know, you've just got a whole gamut of things that make life more difficult when it comes to eating.
What's the difference when the breakthrough comes? You must have observed that, you know, that you kind of fix the situation. How does life change in the family, for example?
Oh, I mean, it's you know, for some parents, it's just, it's always a relief to say, I can move forwards, because the primary problem for parents is that they've tried absolutely everything they can. Nothing's helped their child, and sometimes their child's even going backwards, and that's really common, and they're dropping foods rather than adding foods, and the parent's in an absolute panic, because the last thing you want is your child going backwards when you've already got a limited diet and all these eating challenges. And so when you start to go forwards, there's just enormous relief that firstly you're not going backwards, and secondly you've got these tools that will help you go forwards.
And do picky eaters take a hit on nutrition ultimately? Does it affect their health?
Again, it's a spectrum, so it depends where you sit on that spectrum.
But peanut butter on crackers every day relentlessly can't be that good for you after a while.
No, it's not. That's not. And it's difficult. It's difficult from a nutritional point of view, but it's also difficult psychosocially, because if all you can eat is, you know, this little box of goodies, then it impacts on when you're at school, it impacts on play dates, it impacts on camp, it impacts on holidays, it impacts on going out with your family to restaurants, it impacts on weddings. You know, there's a thousand places. If you think about social occasions, it almost always revolves around food.
Okay, I see here, eating, I think you've explained it, I don't know if you put the number on it, 60 steps up to anyway, and you've distilled those down into 7.
Do you
want to quickly list those off? Would that help?
Okay, so depending on who you speak to, eating happens over multiple steps. Like most things, it's contingent on where your benchmarks sit or whatever. But I love to use the comparison. So if you're an averagely competent eater, your eating from start to finish is about 25 steps. If you're a picky eater, you're looking at around 35 steps. If you're neurodiverse, it could be 40 to 60 steps.
Whoa,
and this concept's really important, because it means if you go with a socially normal policy of plonking a food on your child's plate and then expecting them to eat it, you're likely to be disappointed. We're programmed to put the food down. If it gets eaten, big tick. If it doesn't, big fail.
Right.
And particularly if you have a really challenged eater, there's all these other steps between first seeing the food and then being able to eat it. And so the way that I work with families, or part of the way that I work with families, is to take those however many steps it is and bring it down to a simple 7. It's far more manageable to contemplate. And step 1 is on the table, and step 7 is eating. And so organically working through those steps in a fun way, so that your child becomes more comfortable around food and feeding, is what I'd set out to do. And what you can do is just make that a daily part of your routine. So rather than, you know, doing this as an intensive therapy session on top of an already packed schedule, you just gently change some of the ways that you do things so that your child is organically building comfort around
Right. Freud. Mm. Got it. Okay, I think you published two books, Creating Confident Eaters and Winner, Winner, I Eat Dinner. That's a great title, by the way. obviously, that's one place, or first base anyway, that people can go to and get some information. And is that available through your website, theconfidenteater.com?
Yes, it is. And we post out both of them. New Zealand-wide. Yeah. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How those books gone?
Oh, I'm on my fourth edition for Creating Confident Eaters and the third edition for Winner, Winner, I Eat Dinner.
Mm. I'm interested in that confident. Is that where it all comes together, having confidence in eating?
I'm glad you asked that because, you know, there's a reason I'm the confident eater. And it's firstly that as a parent, you've got to be confident that, you know, that you can make a difference and that you can, you know, support your child to eat more widely and well. But also for the child, they've got to be confident that they can do this because part of the problem is parents don't have the confidence. Children don't have the confidence. How the heck are we ever going to move forward? You think about reading. If no one's confident that the child's going to read, what are the chances of them doing it well?
A paralysis of confidence.
Absolutely.
You don't want that. Mm-hmm. Judith, it's been great talking to you. Really interesting. Thanks for coming on and sharing your knowledge on RCR. Judith Yeebsley, The Confident Eater. Really interesting. Thank you.
Fantastic, Paul. Thanks. It's been a joy to be on. Thank you very much.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.